Stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them.
I get to interview my friend Martha Cole, whom I've known for a long time, probably almost 20 years now. One of the first people that I met when I moved to Montana. And we happen to be able to sit here together and record face to face from 6 feet apart. So if it seems a little quiet, turn up the volume. So Martha and I met many years ago, and I got to work with her daughter when we were training for her bat mitzvah. And I got to show up to your book launch party at the Montana Historical Society, Montana Brides, right? Is that what?
I do, A Cultural History of Montana Weddings, yeah.
Oh my gosh, that was such a good book. And when I started thinking about stories and how important it is to start collecting our stories now, so that future generations will see and hear exactly what we went through, exactly what we experienced, because we don't have a lot of access to that from previous experiences like this pandemic type. Coleworks is running a program right now where they have a survey online for people to complete. And that survey has all kinds of questions about how we are experiencing this pandemic from our homes in Montana. And I thought that was a perfect way to begin talking about saving our stories so that future generations can read them. And when I asked her a particular question, she said, oh, I have a story, but it's not that interesting. And it just made it so clear to me that I still have a lot of work to do to tell people that their stories are interesting and important and valuable. And this coming from a woman who's collecting other people's stories. So Martha, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I don't know that we've had a conversation, like a real conversation in a few years at least.
It's been a while, yeah.
That's awesome.
It's good to sit down with you.
Yeah, so you know I have this book coming out, Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. And it's all about collecting those stories. Whether you think somebody else is going to listen to them or want to be interested in them, it's not really part of the equation for this particular book. It's more a matter of being able to see the experiences that you've had in your life and see the connections between those experiences and your internal messages and how you're being perceived by the people around you. But I filled out the survey for the Historical Society, and I immediately wanted to reach out to you to remind people how important it is to save these stories, these day-to-day experiences. People can say, I was in Montana at 9/11, and this is how I felt. But it's not the same as saying, when we heard the news, I was sitting on my couch, and I remember this vivid memory of being at the top of one of those World Trade Center buildings and talking about a very specific way that experience impacted you. So I would love to start with why you started this program. What were you thinking when this project came up?
Sure. Well, you know, 1918 was a really hard year for the world with the influenza epidemic. That was sort of the last time that we've really had a worldwide epidemic like this. And we have some records from that, from the flu. Some people kept diaries. There's a great diary from a young man who was in Bozeman at college, and the college got shut down, but he was part of the student military. I mean, I'm not sure if it was called ROTC back then. I don't think it was, but basically that's what he was doing. And so they stayed on campus and he wrote about what his life was like. And so there are these records, but we just thought, how great would it be to get more and better records for the future to be able to capture this? Because this really is a life-changing, world-changing event. And so, and it's recognizable as such, you know, it's defined and it's definite. And when you have these, you know, we know that people are going to be studying this later. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to create a record set, and also to give Montanans a time, a place to reflect. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so both thinking about it for future generations of historians, but also thinking about it for the people here, that it's really helpful to imagine yourself as being part of this life-changing event, that this isn't just happening to you, it's happening to the world, it's not personal. You know, no one is dying for your inconvenience. That we're all going through something really big together, I think, and is helpful as a frame for people to process their emotions. So it was both a combination of thinking it would be great for people later, but it equally great for people now.
And that's exactly why I found it to be such a powerful idea. Because yes, it's going to be great for generations in the future to look back and have day-to-day journal style stories from people experiencing it. But for me, sharing those stories helps you process an experience. And by process, I mean really start to separate yourself from the experience to see it as an experience and not as a, this is a personal affront to my life and my life is miserable. So what I love about this is something that you said to me when we were talking about doing this podcast was that we are all actors in this, that this is our opportunity to really take stock in our choices, because what we do today matters. We're not bystanders. This is a global experience.
I would argue that we are always historical actors and our choices always matter, but that sometimes that's in brighter relief than other times. And this is one time where people can really see it. It's very obvious. And anything that can help us, to me, see ourselves as historical actors as is something that is going to make our lives better and more meaningful. Because our choices, our behavior, they matter. They matter to the world, they matter to our family, they matter to our community, and they matter to history. But most of the time people just think, oh, you know, I'm just going along.
Right.
And life is just happening to me. But even when it feels like life is just happening and I'm just doing, you know, the day-to-day stuff that gets me by, you're still an actor in history. You're still making choices. So this is one of the gifts of a really horrible situation is, I think, it becomes clear to people. And like, you know, in World War II, you know, for example, when people were being drafted and enlisting and, you know, active on home front, you know, activities, people saw, oh, wait, this is important. I'm important. Right. And I think this is another moment where people are important and you're important. But really, every moment is that.
Right. But we don't understand the consequences of our actions in as, like you said, in this point in time, we can really see what the consequences are of our actions or inaction, mm-hmm. as the case may be.
Yeah, it's hard to have that frame. But I think once you start to think about the world that way, it changes the way you walk through the world.
But you have to know it. I mean, you have to know that your story matters, that what you do matters. And I think a lot of people, they feel small. They don't feel like they can contribute necessarily. And I think that's part of what that project does for me, is it helps people to understand that they can contribute, that they are part of this, and their stories matter. It just comes right back to that.
It absolutely does. And, you know, to me, it's one of the great gifts of history, really. Particularly, I think most people think of history as presidents and big political figures and generals. That's mm-hmm. not how I think of history. I think of history as us, You know, we are history, or we will be history, you know, in a few years, and the people who are just like us. So it's not the Rosa Parks of this world, as great as they are, the Martin Luther Kings of this world. It's the everyday ordinary person who chose not to get on, to support the bus boycott, you know, that makes history, right? That is part of history. And even, you know, forget about trying to change the world. It's everybody who just wants to change their own circumstance and decides to come homestead in Montana and take out 180 acres. They're not doing it for any grand principle. They're just doing this because it seems like what is going to make their lives better. And they transform Montana. And you can say they transformed it for good in some ways and for bad in some other ways, and their own lives for good in some ways and for bad in other ways. It's a you know, but their actions are historic.
Right.
And I think that's the gift that, like, of studying history, is that you all of a sudden you start to realize, you know, my book was on weddings, and I chose weddings because it's what many, many people do. It's relatively universal. And if you're only going to document one moment in your life, what you're probably going to document is your wedding. So it provides a window into the lives of ordinary people through time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the smallest, most personal thing is a way to look at culture and history and what life was like back then.
Mm-hmm. And it can inform what life will be like, because we know history repeats itself.
Yeah, I mean, first time a tragedy, second time a farce, but
it gives you context for the future. I know that most of the historians that I know are kind of prescient in that, like Bob, my husband, he has studied a ridiculous amount of history and individual stories, biographies, and individual time period, very short time period, so that you could really see how the world was shaped by what seemed to be small activities and events, mm-hmm. but really transformed that time period. And there are so many times where he has accurately predicted things that were going to happen in different parts of the world.
That's really interesting. See, and almost the thing that attracts me to history is almost the opposite of that. It's being able to go back into a time that's really different and realize, you know, so, and one of the books that made me decide I wanted to be a historian was a book called The Waning of the Middle Ages that I read when I was 17. And it's actually, you know, been quite discredited. It's no longer, you know, source that people go to, but it was transformational to me because he painted a picture of everyday life as so profoundly different, and of the way that people thought and interacted. And this was in the 80s, and I was a left-wing kid in the Reagan era. And I thought, things used to be really, really unimaginably different back then. That means things can be unimaginably different in the future. So it's almost not looking for repetition, but looking for change, or just looking for the fact that, wow, you know, it's not predetermined and it could be different, was something that I found really motivating at 17.
Wow. That is such a flip side. And it's still, though, it's not a contradiction, because though it's different, there are still patterns. And patterns of human behavior that never seem to go away.
Absolutely. No, there are so many patterns, and it's so easy to look back at different periods, you know, even in the last 10 years and say, wow, this really reminds me of,
right.
And this really reminds me of the Gilded Age. This right. really reminds me of the Progressive Era. This really reminds me of, you know,
Industrial Revolution.
You know, and, yeah, right. exactly. You know, right. And so there's a lot of ways to look and say, yeah, I recognize some things that are going on here in this kind of big way. And then we have a choice as individuals. How do we respond to that?
Right.
You know, because nothing is predetermined. And that's the other thing that I think when people think about history, they don't realize. It seems like, yeah, of course women got the vote. Of course desegregation happened. You know, of course, whatever it is, like everything seems completely inevitable after the fact. But nothing was inevitable. It was all because of choices that people made. you know? And so there's no, of course. So that's the other great comfort or challenge or purveyor of meaning, I guess, mm-hmm. is it's none of it's inevitable. None of it's predetermined. So we get to write it.
You just gave me a lot of different things to think about. I'm speaking of processing, I have a whole lot of different things going through my head. I read the book, The Mapmaker's Wife, and it is the story of Isabel Godin, who is the wife of one of the famous French mapmakers that went to South America to triangulate the distances across the Andes and figure out the actual distance around the Earth. How big was the Earth at its equator? That was what they were trying to figure out. They were mapping the world, basically, from South America. And he met this woman, fell in love with her, disappeared for years, and they would write letters that they would get maybe every 6 months. And he went back a couple times to get her pregnant, and both times she ended up with a miscarriage. So they didn't have a baby. And then they finally did have a baby, and she died at 18, and he never actually got to meet her. He was gone that long. But the story just completely drew me in. This one woman's experience in the 1800s, and she was 40 when she ended up, when she started a trek through the Amazon, across the Andes and through the Amazon to meet her husband. And she started with a whole entourage, and she was the only survivor.
Wow.
And this was at 40, she was old. You know, that was geriatric in the 1800s. And she did this trek and she survived it. And suddenly I saw history in a completely different way. It was so approachable. It was so fantastic. And somebody that I could really admire and relate to in some ways, because I'm pretty adventurous myself. So I'm curious, you said that you weren't a history person until you read that book. What was the next step when you said, okay, this is it, I'm totally into this?
Well, let me go back first and say that, you know, I was stuck in a vacation cabin, pre-internet, no television, with a sprained ankle when I read that book. So I was not the precocious 17-year-old and very little reading material lying around. It was not a choice. You know, I had the Blue Fairy book. I probably had a Stephen King novel, which I absolutely read first. And then there was The Waning of the Middle Ages. You know, so just so like. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, and I mean, there were moments of interest prior to that. I had a great junior teacher in 10th grade who taught world history, who had been a nun in a closed convent in the Sisters of the Precious Blood. And she had, when we got to the Middle Ages, she talked about the rule of her convent that had not changed, you know, and getting up at, you know, 5 a.m. and saying prayers and all the periods of silence. And she lived, I don't know, 10 blocks from her parents, but wasn't allowed to see them but once a year because it was a closed order. And so that was like, wow, this was how people lived. Like, people live these things. And I think that's what you're responding to, too, is... And I think that is the great failing of our education system, is that is not what people think history is.
Right.
But that is absolutely what history is. History is how people live. And, you know, the other thing that sort of drew me were family stories, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom told lots of amazing stories about her grandma, who... grew up in a shtetl in, you know, sometimes Russia, sometimes Poland. The borders changed. It didn't matter. It was all bad for the Jews kind of place. And her dad was a very scholarly man. And so he studied Torah all the time, which meant that his wife had to run the inn and make a living and have lots of children. And so basically three wives got worked to death. And my great grandma was of the second wife. And her telling of the story, the third wife was the quintessential evil stepmother. You got to have a little bit of sympathy for the third wife who had all these stepchildren plus an inn to run, you know,
right.
plus getting pregnant and having her own children. Like her. But anyway, she was like terribly evil in my grandmother's telling of it. And my grandma, our great grandma, ran away at 15 and came with bondsmen to America. And so those wow. kind of stories about her courage and what she did and how she managed life when she got here, you know, so that was part of the family kind of background and my way of thinking about the world. And then, you know, my dad's stories, but also about being active in the civil rights movement in the 1940s and 1950s. So before things got like change
right.
was really happening, but working for change back in this period where it didn't feel as possible. You know,
right.
And then growing up with tons and tons of stories about labor heroes, you know, so I was just raised on stories of union organizers like Joe Hill and anarchists like Emma Goldman. And, you know, I mean, so I was raised with all these stories about all these people in history who were trying to live their principles and make the world better. And so many failed strikes and so much death and so much, I mean, like really, they failed more than they succeeded by a lot.
Oh, absolutely.
And so it was bloody and lots of people. And it wasn't like, oh, you can make a difference necessarily, but it was like people try. And it's that trying in a way that matters mm-hmm. as much as succeeding, right?
Right.
Is sort of living in a way that is trying to influence the world, whether and in 1948, you know, my dad wasn't really influencing anything at all. You know, they didn't win at all, you know, when he was doing civil rights work.
He was planting those seeds.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Right.
And that's what has to happen. And I think that brings us right back to this whole idea that your stories matter, that you are planting seeds. And it's not just by telling these stories or by the actions that you're taking, but the influence that you wield. People are so surprised at the influence that they do. They don't know. And what your dad was doing, everyone he talked to, everyone who looked up to him, his children, whoever he interacted with, he had some influence, positive or negative, there was some influence there. And all of us have that.
Exactly. We all do. And we all build together the world that we live in. And that doesn't matter if we're talking the world of our family, the world of our neighborhood, the world of our town, you know, or the world writ large. But we work together to build it and all the time. And we make different, it looks different in different generations and in different iterations because of how we behave.
Right. And I think it comes back to our values and living in alignment with our values, that our actions really have to be in alignment with our values. And I think that's also a good opportunity when you're writing your stories. What you're writing is something you would want generations ahead of you to see or behind you to see. And I talk about that a lot when I talk about personal brand in my keynotes. I talk about if you're going to put something out there that you wouldn't want your mother to see or for your children to see, then don't put it out there. And it's the same with your actions, because everyone around you, you're modeling behavior for everyone around you. It's not just your kids. So when you smile at a stranger at the grocery store and they smile back, there are other people nearby that see that and are influenced by it one way or another. So I think by writing these stories, we have to take account of our behavior and our actions and how it may potentially influence or impact people around us.
Yeah, for sure. I also think, you know, just thinking about kind of stories and history, it's important to think about it with ourselves, too. We definitely need to work on making our values align with our stories, align with the stories we tell ourselves and others. We need to try to live the best lives we can in the most moral way. And we're always going to fail.
Of course.
Always.
And sharing those failures is important.
Sharing those failures is important because it makes it more real. But recognizing too that people in the past failed magnificently all the time, you know, that they weren't always kind, that they weren't always the person that they wanted to be, you know. We look back at things like World War II and, you know, these plucky, you know, keep calm and carry on, you know, plucky Brits, you know, and we're like, wow, they were so brave. And yeah, they were. And also they had nervous breakdowns, and also they were short-tempered with one another, and also, you know. Right. So it's like both and. It's both true that we need to put forth that best self and try to live that best self, and also be somewhat forgiving and patient with ourselves when...
Because we're complicated.
Because we're complicated, and life is complicated. And, you know, it's really, it would be paralyzing to have to have every choice in alignment, you know.
I may be all of these things, but if I do one thing that's out of alignment and people see it, and then they hold on to that regardless of everything else that I've accomplished in my life, if they hold on to that one thing I did wrong, you're freezing me in time. And I think people have a tendency to do that to other people because it's easier that way. You categorize them, and then they fit into that category. No matter what evidence is out there that they don't actually fit in that category, it's easier that way. It's organized.
Right. And I think in when we look at historical figures, especially ones that we admire, we tend to freeze them in time in almost the opposite way.
Right.
Where they only ever did good.
But we know the truth.
We know.
Nobody
that people
ever,
no,
always does good.
Exactly. You know, people are complicated. And I think when we can take them off pedestals and see them as real human beings who are complicated, then the world feels more possible for us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, oh, I could never be like Martin Luther King, you know, and I could never actually could be like Martin Luther King. I could never be like, you know, someone who did something really great because they're so great because I put them on a pedestal. Right. But when you actually look at all the ins and outs and the uncertainties and the missteps and the depressions and the times when, you know, whatever it is, then you're like, oh, wait, they were a real person and I'm a real person and they made lots of mistakes. And I make lots of mistakes, and that's okay. And we can still try, you know, we can still
create something around us.
Yeah, exactly.
And participate. So you're right. We can participate in the community that we're building, and knowing that we aren't perfect, being okay with that, I think is a big part of processing those experiences and looking back and knowing that, acknowledging that we did something wrong can also bring us to a new place to say, okay, I did that wrong, but I can start over. I can do this now.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are all for me. I mean, and obviously you learned all these lessons in a different way, but to me, these are all like really great gifts.
So before we wrap this up, I would love to hear one story, a pivot point where you read something or had a conversation with somebody that really, you can look back now, you may not have known it then, but you can look back now and say, this is why I do what I do, why I have the passion for the work that I do. I mean, you've given us some already. The fact that you have those stories from your family, I don't have those stories. I heard some, but I don't remember sitting and really listening. I don't remember them really writing anything down. And I know we have some really interesting stories in our history, but I don't have that as a reason or a way to show interest in history.
So let me just talk about something recent. And our archivist chose letters from Montanans at war that they wrote to people, and they put together a reader's theater. And I changed it into a curriculum where students would study particular letters and then they would perform them. And one of the teachers that picked that curriculum up was Rob Holter at Helena High School. And your son was in his theater class when he did this. And they did a performance. And at the end of that performance, there was a question and answer period. And the kids talked about saying, they said things like, before I didn't think history had anything to do with me, but now I realize it is about me. These people were ordinary, just like me, and they did stuff to make a difference. I can do that too. You know, and if I had scripted what these children were going to say, I could not have made a better script. I was so just overjoyed that reading these letters from everyday Montanans made them think, wow, I'm an everyday Montanan and I'm important too. And my actions are important and my actions shape history. And so that was a tremendously validating moment. I was just like, I mean, I was just over the moon. I mean, I did tear up a little bit when I said that kind of stuff. But I was just so, you know, pleased. No, it was really, and I talked to Rob Holter, the teacher, afterwards, and he talked about some of his students who really struggled with self-worth and struggled with school and struggled with this idea that they were important and how much they gravitated to some of these letters and how meaningful it was to them. And I thought, all right, yeah.
Yeah.
This is it.
That is the purpose.
Yeah.
That's magical. Those are the times where you can walk away and know that there's a difference to be made. I mean, just like you're telling the students they made a difference, you pushed that. You were the foundation for that difference. And I have to come back to that story because when Max, our son, was participating in it, I went to see it. And I remember there would be a narrator talking about the context of the letter, where it came from, who was involved, and then the student reading the letter as an actor. I remember in particular during the Q&A when one student said that her, I can't remember if it was a boy or girl, but their sibling, their brother, was stationed in somewhere in the Middle East.
Probably Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yes, yeah. At the time of these letters. They were stationed there. And this young student said, I'm going to start writing letters to him. We do email, but I'm going to start writing physical handwritten letters. And one of the things a few of those students got out of that was the value of a handwritten letter, how much meaning you can find in the way the person writes something, the penmanship, the paragraphs, the physicality of a handwritten letter. And these are students that I don't know if they really had ever been exposed to handwritten letters. I mean, my kids did because they had to handwrite thank you notes, especially after bar mitzvah. But I know that a lot of kids aren't exposed to that kind of communication.
And I would say, like, and I thought that was hilarious. I do. The kids were like, yeah, we're going to write letters. But partly it was, you know, we want our memories and we want ourselves to be recorded for history, for posterity, right? And I was just like, yeah, sure you are, right? You know, like there's no way. I didn't think. But I did think it was important to think of recording your memory. So I don't care if it's a letter or an email that's printed out.
Right.
It's really hard to, it's electronic records are still really a huge challenge for archivists. Mm-hmm. We try. I mean, I'm not an archivist. They try. To capture, and this survey is all online, right? So people are typing, and we're going to have to figure out a way to capture it, whether it's printing out everybody's stuff and actually putting it physically in file folders, or whether it's preserving it electronically in a way that can, technology changes so fast.
Right.
So if you think about like 5-inch floppies, right, we can't read them anymore unless we have a special machine,
right.
You know, or Word Perfect files, you know.
Oh my God.
I mean, right. So it's actually a lot more complicated than people think to preserve records right now. We're in this kind of crisis point for archives, which is a totally different subject that's a little bit off the point. But
now, it's an important aspect of it because we're talking about history here.
You know, and we want to preserve it for the future anyway. So the fact that these kids understood, because it's true that their experiences were historical and worth preserving and their thoughts and feelings about a particular thing were worth preserving, I thought was just fabulous.
I thought so too. I just got a chill just remembering that. And that was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, but I still have vivid memories of that experience. And I've talked about it with people, how important it is to share those stories with each other just for that reason, because it does remind people that they matter, asking those questions. And I'll just come right back to that survey at the Montana Historical Society website. For those of you in Montana that want to complete that survey. I did it, and I'm kind of impulsive, so I just started answering the questions. But what I would recommend is that you, if you're going to complete that survey, that you either take a screenshot or copy and paste the questions into a separate document. Take your time answering them. Write whatever you're going to write, and then copy and paste it back into the survey when you're ready to complete it. Because I think I would have taken a lot more time on it had I done it that way.
If you're not in Montana, other historical societies are doing this too. We are not unique. Lots of historical societies are encouraging people to keep diaries and journals mm-hmm. of this time. And I would encourage that as well, just as a more thoughtful. The survey is a snapshot in time at a moment, but in some ways, what might be more interesting is seeing your day-to-day feelings and adventures and things that happen and things that you think and how it evolves over time. And that would be a journal situation. And I'm sure, you know, that might be something you could donate to a local historical society or just keep for your, you know,
kids, grandkids, neighbors' kids someday.
Exactly. You know, so those are other things that, you know, where we got the idea to do this survey was a friend of mine's son is in college and the college shut down, you know, and he was really worried about losing his work study job. You know, they went to distance learning like right. so many colleges did, and he worked in the library. And the librarian told him that he would pay him to journal his experience because they wanted it for their archives, right? So that he would be making his work study was, you know,
to journal.
Oh, I mean, not
brilliant.
15 hours a week, but, you know, but yeah.
So it's
exactly. And I thought, what? Because he, you know, recognized this as such a significant moment in history and how important it was to capture in, you know, in this case for their college, sort of the youth response and perspective. And it was like, yeah, wow, we need to do that too. You know, we need to try to reach out and capture. So journals are great. The survey is great. We'd love to hear from you. We have about, I looked today and there was like 179 people who have entered the adult one. And I didn't look on the student one. We have two, one for students and one for adults. It's been fun. Some teachers have been assigning it to their students. In Corvallis, they did. Great. Up in Savage, she assigned them to her students. I know a teacher in Savage that did that.
That's
so
great.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. I hadn't thought about the journaling aspect of it. I mean, I thought about it, but I hadn't thought about it in this context. And I know that I'm not consistent enough to journal consistently, but I did kind of keep a journal of sorts when I was a study abroad student in Australia, because I knew that was such a unique time in my life. So that totally makes sense. And I would hope that people would consider that. And I can tell you that my journal wasn't paragraph after paragraph. There were pages where I just wrote the date and wrote a few key phrases to remind myself of what happened that day that was interesting. So saw my first huntsman spider and described it, which was terrifying, bigger than my hand, extended hand. And I remember writing some notes to myself after I had seen the U2 concert that I saw when I was in Brisbane, Australia, where B.B. King opened up for him. And I remember, I can look at that journal now, and again, I don't have it written as a narrative, but I can look back now and remember the things that happened. So I would encourage, if you're not a journal kind of person, just even jotting down notes like that would be really helpful in your future, probably for external processing in your future.
For you, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I so wish, I'm not a journaling person, and I so wish I had written, I was, because my memory is terrible. And, you know, my kids would say, oh, what was I like when I was, you know, two? And I'm like, I don't know.
Go look at the pictures.
Who knows? You know, you were a two-year-old. It was fun.
You're all the same at two.
I mean, which is so not true, but like, I wish so much. And I always thought, oh, I'm going to remember this. This is so real and I'm so immersed in it, and whatever it is, I'm going to remember it. I'm going to take a mental picture. You know, I'm not a photography person either.
Right.
So when I traveled, I didn't, you know, when I was in college, I didn't take photographs. And like, yes, but I'm taking photographs with my mind. Yeah, well, my mind is a sieve, you know, so I really wish I had better, I were a better record keeper of my own history.
I know. I think a lot of us feel that way. Every once in a while, I would jot down a funny way that one of my kids said something, mm-hmm. like Pischetti instead of spaghetti. And there are a few. Here's a tip for people who have bad memories who want to remember those things. This is something that I've been doing for years. Is shortly after something would happen, I would call my mother and tell her the story, or I would call my mother and then I'd call my sister. I would tell at least 3 or 4 or 5 people the story mm-hmm. of something particular that Jacob or Max did that made me laugh or that made me cry or that I found particularly important. And by telling the story over and over again, I was able to create strong memories.
Yeah, you know, that doesn't work for me. I mean, it's terrible. And because I thought that would. But yeah, my memory is that bad. And what did work for me was there was a period when Nate was little before Anna was born. So my oldest, I was emailing my mom and dad uh-huh. the cute things he did. And then when I had a second child, who had time for that? And so I have his first 4 years and like, you know, how cute he was. For her, not so much.
Oh, it's not the case all the time. Yeah, I know. By the third kid, you have like 4 pictures, right?
Yeah, I'm number 4 in my family.
Yeah, so. More pictures of you. Well, if our listeners are looking for more information about Martha and her work and about the Montana Historical Society, I will have some links on the blog post associated with this podcast, including the link to Montana Historical Society website and that particular survey. And I will also dig in and see if I can find some resources for other states that are doing a similar program. I'm sure that between Martha and I, we can do some quick Google stalking and find some states that are doing it in case listeners from other parts of the country are interested in participating. And I just have one question. Is there going to be a search feature for that survey that would not necessarily give a name with the answer, but where people can actually see some of what's been written so far?
I have no idea.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's something to think about.
That is something that would be really interesting. It was interesting in preparation for this conversation. I kind of scrolled through a lot of the answers and just to see how people were framing the experience. And the thing that was came up over and over again, you know, in advice, one of the questions is what do you want people in the future to know about this, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just be kind, be kind, be kind, you know. Oh, and wonderful. It was, you know, the community can pull together, you know. We pull together through this. And, you know, that kind of.
Those are stories that need to be reminded.
You know, and I think people, by writing them, make it true. Like, you know, and this is, I think, more your bailiwick. But when you say, you know, we pulled together and we helped our neighbors and you write that down, it's an intention. As well as a record, and
absolutely, yeah. It kind of makes you realize that this is important mm-hmm. when you write it down, mm-hmm. and you want people to read it someday. You want them to see the good that was happening, the good that you did, and the good that happened to you.
Right.
Those are all really important aspects of it. And I also have some of those answers that Martha printed for me. So I will type a few of those in.
I can email screenshots. I'll just email to you.
Yeah. So we'll have some little snippets of the responses that the Historical Society has received so far. And again, to our listeners, this is a great time. If you were ever going to start journaling, this is a great time to do it. Thank you so much, Martha.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Listen to me, honey, while I say How could you tell me that you're going?